Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 23, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Courthouse Steps teleform conference call. Today, we'll be talking about yesterday's Kimball versus Marvel Enterprises decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording this call for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back a return guest to Teleforum. Gregory Dolan is a professor and co-director of the Center for Medicine and Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. He's going to give us a little background on the case, talk about the decision, then maybe talk about some of the implications of the decision. And then, as always, we'll be looking to you for questions. So please do be thinking of your questions in advance for when we get to that part of the program. I think his opening remarks are going to be about 15 to 20 minutes or so. With that, Professor Dolan, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dean. It's always a pleasure to be here, so thanks for inviting me back. I'm going to talk about Kimball. Just give you a little bit of background first, and then sort of talk about a decision and, what I think the majority got right and wrong. But before I do that, sort of just to put my own cards on the table, I am fairly convinced that I think dissent got it right, and I will try sort of to stay as neutral as I possibly can, but to the extent that anybody sees or feels that there's any color into my views, I just wanted to get that out of there, out of the open first. In any event, the case arose when an inventor named Kimball invented a device for shooting foam out of your own palms or hands. So you attach this thing to your hands, and then you can shoot foam. It's a toy. Thereafter, a company, Marvel, that owns a copyright to Spider-Man, decided to create toys that would allow the same thing to happen, where you can have a Spider-Man toy that would be able to shoot webs, i.e. foam, from his hand. Kimball eventually sued Marvel for patent infringement after unsuccessfully trying to license the patent to them. He sued them. Eventually, the suit was settled on fairly amicable terms. And the terms were that Marvel would pay Kimball a royalty fee for every Spider-Man toy that they would sell. The agreement itself had no end date. So the parties, as they entered into this agreement, they contemplated that as long as Marvel would continue selling these toys that are able to shoot out foam from its hands, Kimball would be able to receive royalties. And that went on for a few years. Again, everybody seemed to have been happy with that arrangement. Kimball was getting his checks. Marvel was selling his toys. Kids were enjoying the ability to act like a Spider-Man. So everybody was happy ultimately the party settled and the terms that they settled on. Eventually, the patent expired, and Marvel updated its toy and at some point stopped paying royalties to Kimball. Kimball was unhappy about it. He sought enforcement. And at that point, Marvel's attorneys discovered an old case that nobody has sort of considered or for that matter even knew about called Brulati versus Theis. I think I'm pronouncing it right. The Theis is spelled T-H-Y-S, and I think that probably is the correct pronunciation. Brulati versus Theis is an old, over 50-year-old decision written by then-Justice Douglas. For a large majority of the court, I believe it was 8-1 with only Justice Harlan dissenting, which basically said in a very sort of conclusory language, in a very sort of short opinion, that agreements which require licensees to continue to pay royalties on a patent after patent's expiration are per se illegal. So that opinion used very much an antitrust language, even though it was interpreting the Patent Act. So they're per se illegal because they are patent misused. The logic that the court used, the logic that Justice Douglas put into that opinion, was basically this, that patents are granted for only a limited period of time. The quid pro quo between the patentee and the public is that in exchange for an exclusive right for 17 years at the time, now it's 20 years, but that back then it was 17, in exchange for that 17 years of exclusivity and our ability to extract whatever profits you can, after the expiration of that period of time, the patent is free for the public, and they can just use it without paying any more monies to the patentee. And Justice Douglas, writing for the court, concluded that by requiring the licensee to continue to pay after the patent has expired, unlawfully extends the patent monopoly. And so that was the decision up until now, until sort of Kimball was granted. But it was such an obscure decision that, like I said, neither Kimball's attorneys nor even Marvel's attorneys, and Marvel is not a small company, really knew about it. It only came to light after the second dispute arose, after Marvel stopped paying Kimball royalties, and they hired basically a new firm to see how they can get out of this contract, and this decision came to light. The Supreme Court granted cert to resolve the question of whether or not this old decision, Brulati, was correctly decided. Because it was, had been severely criticized both by academics, by judges. Judge Posner wrote in an opinion that although it's pretty clear that current economic theory would reject Brulati, they are not free to overrule Supreme Court decision. The Ninth Circuit, from where this very case came up, wrote something very similar, that although they have serious questions about the correctness of Brulati, they're not free to ignore binding Supreme Court precedent. And so Supreme Court granted cert to decide whether or not Brulati should go. I had the pleasure of being at the oral argument. Again, thanks in large part to the Federalist Society. It was, and then I did a teleforum as well on that. And what was interesting in the oral argument is that very few people defended actually the logic of Brulati. I think everybody has recognized, or most everybody has recognized, that Brulati is a bit of an odd duck, especially after the antitrust law has been brought into alignment with the current economic theory. Brulati was kind of just hanging out there all alone, nearly forgotten. Justice Breyer did express some views as to perhaps to the contrary, where he would seem to be the strongest proponent of the Brulati rule. But even he perhaps could have been convinced that the per se rule announced by Brulati, that, you know, always such agreements to pay royalties after patent expiration are illegal, may be too far. And so when I left the oral argument, I thought there was a good chance that Brulati would go, that Brulati would be overruled. One thing that gave me pause back then, and ultimately proved to be a prescient fear, is that a lot of people, in fact, the United States as an amicus and a number of justices expressed serious reservations as to whether or not they should overturn precedent, even one that's incorrectly decided, in a statutory area. And ultimately, that is how the case came down. So yesterday, the Supreme Court issued its opinion, written by Justice Kagan, 6-3, basically saying that Brulati will remain the law of the land simply because it has been on the books for a long time. So the majority opinion was mostly a pan to the stare decisis. No one, neither the majority nor the dissent, really took any pains to defend the logic of Brulati. In fact, Justice Kagan opened when she talked her opinion by talking about how this is all about stare decisis, and stare decisis only really make sense as a rule of law when it comes to the incorrectly decided cases. She said that if the old case was decided correctly, you don't really need stare decisis as a doctrine, because if it's correct, we'll just reaffirm it. Stare decisis only makes sense is to uphold incorrectly decided cases. So pretty much tipping her hat to her hand that this the old decision was indeed incorrectly decided. But nonetheless, the said that the court will abide by it. One question that the majority had to deal with, and ultimately, from my perspective, dealt with it somewhat unpersuasively, was the question of what makes this area of law different from antitrust law. Because in antitrust law, as I mentioned a few moments ago, the court has been somewhat active in overruling old precedents that are no longer consistent with a prevailing economic theory. And yet here, even though the ultimate conclusion in Brulati rested on the same economic theory, the court was much more hesitant. the majority opine that the reason that they will be more reticent in overruling Brulati than they would be in overruling old patent old antitrust decisions was because of the difference between the Patent Act and the Sherman Act. In majority's view, the Sherman Act really was meant to be a common law developed statute where the courts were meant to be much more active and were meant to create rules and then adjust those rules as need be, where the phrase, as the majority put it, that the phrase restraint of trade has changing content and dynamic potential. But the same thing is just not true about patent law. The court said that Congress has changed and adjusted and fine-tuned patent law on numerous occasions over the last 50 years, had an opportunity to legislatively overrule Brulati, and yet failed to do so. And so that is basically where majority left it. The dissent, authored by Justice Alito and joined by the Chief Justice and Justice Thomas, concluded that Brulati should be overruled, that it was, A, incorrectly decided, a point that majority, like I said, did not dispute, but B, said that stare decisis really holds no particular sway or shouldn't hold any particular sway in this case because, in his view, what the Brulati court did, even though it said it was interpreting Patent Act, in reality it was interpreting patent policy. And so in that sense, according to the Justice Alito's dissent, it's not even clear that Congress would have been successful, even had it tried, to overrule Brulati legislatively. Because in Justice Alito's view, Brulati had these almost constitutional underpinnings that patents could not be granted for anything but promotion of sciences and useful arts, and that the court may have been very skeptical that at least applying this old economic theory would have been very skeptical that licenses that extend past the patent expiration term would serve that, and very well may have rejected that law as well. So Justice Alito thought that, number one, Brulati was wrongly decided, a view that's shared apparently by the majority of the justices, but also disputed the notion that there's any difference between patent and antitrust law in terms of the strength of stare decisis or that stare decisis has particular application to this case. One more thing I should mention before I turn it over back to Dean and for questions is the oddity of Brulati and now Kimball is this. Majority openly acknowledge in its opinion that even though they're going to retain Brulati, Brulati is very easy to get around. So, for example, if instead of writing a contract, if Kimball and Marvel, instead of writing a contract that said Kimball would get royalties for an indefinite period of time, if they instead would have written a contract that said Kimball and Marvel will form a joint enterprise, some sort of subsidiary or corporation, where they will split profits in whatever proportion they decide for an indefinite period of time, that would not run afoul of Brulati because the magic words, patent royalties, would be absent. Yesterday on a IP professor's discussion listserv, Professor John Duffy at the University of Virginia suggested another, for example, way that this could have been gotten around. That instead of writing patent royalties in the agreement, if, for example, Kimball said, I'm willing to exchange my patent rights in full for a sliver of your copyrights with Marvel, and copyrights, of course, last longer than patents, that would be, and so that he would be able to get monies, profits, far into the future, that would also be okay. And there's a myriad of other ways of just getting around Brulati. So the oddity of this decision is that although it remains law of the land, a creative contract writer could completely gut it and get to the same result. And so it seems to me, like I said, I will put my cards on the table that I think majority got it wrong. It seems to me that not only did they get it wrong as a matter of economic theory or as a matter of stare decisis, I happen to agree, I think, with Justice Alito's criticism, but also they got it wrong in that it doesn't even serve the purposes that it actually – the Brulati doesn't serve the purposes that it announces to have served, that it does not actually prevent people from collecting money on their patents far into the future if they're creative enough in writing their contracts. So with that, I think I'll turn it over to Dean. I'm happy to entertain any questions on this case or on Brulati.
Well, thank you very much, Professor. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, you'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question for Professor Dolan, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, we've got plenty of time for Q&A. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to questions, let me make a quick announcement. We don't have scheduled telephone conference calls later this week, but the Supreme Court has announced that it will be deciding cases, handing down opinions on Thursday and Friday. So it's quite likely we will have telephone conference calls Thursday and or Friday. And, of course, next Monday is a decision day as well. There are 7 cases left undecided from the term this year, so there's a lot of content likely to be covered in upcoming telephone conference calls in the next several days. To access that, you can monitor your emails and, of course, go to the Federal Society's Teleforum webpage to see how that calendar develops. But for today, of course, we're talking about Kimball versus Marvel Enterprises with Professor Gregory Dolan. If you have a question, our lines are wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And Professor, while we're waiting to see if anyone rings in, you mentioned, well, let me ask you this question first. How much is the Kimball case a patent case versus a stare decisis case? I mean, how much should practitioners pay attention to this decision on stare decisis? Is the and were you surprised there wasn't a fourth vote on the stare decisis issue, or what? Can you say more about that?
Sure. I think it is almost exclusively a stare decisis case. Like I said, I don't think anybody in a I don't know if anybody. I can't quite say if anybody in a majority believes that Brulati was correctly decided, but the majority opinion does not make an argument that it was. Like I said, in fact, it opens up with this. With a statement that stare decisis is there to protect wrong decisions, kind of implying that they agree that as a matter of economics, as a matter of common sense, Brulati is just wrong, but they're going to stick with that decision. I'm not sure how much, you know, how much you, what's the takeaway message from this is. I suppose the takeaway message from it from this is that to the extent that there are longstanding patent precedents, Supreme Court is unlikely to overrule them. Because the Supreme Court has, the majority has said in numerous places in the opinion that Patent Act mistakes are for Congress to correct. Now, it doesn't mean I don't think Supreme Court will start being less active in patent arena, because there may be novel questions of law. So, for example, recently, a couple of years ago, they decided a question on patentability of DNA. Before that, they were talking about patentability of computer programs and business method patents. So I don't think the Supreme Court will shy away from those novel questions. But to the extent that something has been settled, I think they will probably this opinion probably announces that they're going to be much more careful about changing well-established patent rules. So I think that's kind of where it comes down. In terms of whether there was a fourth, why this was 6-3 as opposed to 5-4, I wouldn't presume to know why, for example, Justice Scalia joined with one wing or the other, or Justice Kagan did, or so on. So, but I think that's the takeaway message, that patent law probably, to the extent that people want changes in patent law, they should direct their efforts to not to 1st Street, but to Pennsylvania Avenue.
Right. If you have a question for the professor, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our phones are wide open at this point. Let me ask you a factual question, and this might or might not have been evident in the record. Was it clear from the record that the parties intended that the payments would last longer than the patent itself?
That seemed to have been the understanding of, at least as it stood in the Supreme Court, because no one was aware of the existence of Brulati. Now, this may have been legal malpractice, one that actually worked out quite well for Marvel and quite poorly for Kimball, but it just really, Brulati sort of came to the attention of the lawyers well into the second litigation over royalties. So it seems that they did, in fact, intend the patents to go on, the royalties to go on much longer than the patent. And that sort of brings up another interesting point that was raised in the opinion that I kind of didn't mention in my opening remarks, is that one of the reasons that majority gave for sticking by the old rule is that they said that there may be a number of patents out there that were drafted with no end date in reliance on the existence of Brulati, basically that parties understood, the number of contracts that were drafted in reliance on Brulati with no end date, where parties understood that they'll expire by force of law because of Brulati being sort of the background norm. There was actually, Alito pointed out in his dissent that there's nothing in the record that actually indicated it, and that is quite unlikely, in fact, because these very parties did not even know of Brulati. But even if that were true, since royalty agreements are just contracts, courts will be free to construe those contracts to carry out parties' intentions. And so, for example, in some other case, parties did, in fact, intend for the royalties to expire. Even if Brulati were overruled, they could sort of construe the contract to mean just that. But majority didn't buy that argument. But that's the other thing. In this case, it seems to me, based on the court's opinion and the oral argument, that the parties did, in fact, intend the contract to go longer because this was not a case about the intent of the parties, but whether or not Brulati would prevent them from carrying out their intent.
We do have a question from the audience. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first question.
Yes, Professor. It's David Emerson, Berkeley, California, a practicing technology intellectual property licensing attorney for many years. From reading the opinion and something that you noted as well, it was indicated that the Brulati case was not generally well known. And, you know, my own personal experience is that out here in Silicon Valley, it's highly known. It's unusual to find patent licensing where the patent term and recognition of potential patent misuse issues is not recognized in the contract. And, for example, in the licensing a portfolio of patents, there would be a step down in royalty as patents basically spin out of their terms. So it's completely different experience from a practitioner level than what was expressed in the briefs and also in your remarks. My question has to do with the doctrine of patent misuse as separate from antitrust doctrine, and in particular tying cases, which is just one example. And your thoughts on whether or not, if Brulati itself were overruled and it was allowed as a potential case of tying the patent monopoly, which is supposed to be a limited term, to effectively an unlimited term, whether that would open up the possibility of other areas of patent law, settled patent law, in cases of tying, different types of tying, to being overruled as well.
I appreciate the question, and I certainly won't argue with experience that it's quite possible that Brulati may be very well known in some industries and perhaps more known in some than others. And perhaps it's known generally, and these lawyers who negotiated these deals were just bad lawyers. I can't point out one way or the other, but the way it came up to the Supreme Court was it was represented that nobody knew of Brulati as the agreement was negotiated. Now, on to the second point, one thing Brulati does not prohibit is that it does not prohibit royalties that extend to the extent that there is a portfolio licensing. It does not prohibit royalties that do not expire until the last patent in the portfolio expires. So you can actually do that. That is not, that may be a run afoul of other doctrines, but that does not run afoul of Brulati. That was actually a limitation Brulati put on itself in that old opinion. So that's another way to get around Brulati. So, for example, Kimball had two patents. He could extend the royalties on both until the very last day of the later expiring patent. So in that sense, perhaps if that's sort of what you mean by tying, that is still permissible, at least under Brulati. And then the final, point I would want to make on what would happen if Brulati were overruled and extending the patent monopoly, I think I take issue with that, the premise of the question, because somebody is paying you royalties on an expired patent doesn't necessarily follow that you continue to enjoy the right to exclude. So, for example, there's two companies, A, the patentee, and B, the licensee, and they agree to pay royalties indefinitely. at some point patent expires, B continues to pay royalties. But the thing of it is that C can now enter the market, and there's nothing that B or A can do to stop it. So I'm not quite sure that there is indeed a monopoly power. There may not even be a monopoly power even during the term of the patent. So, for example, if I come up with a new analgesic to relieve headaches, I probably won't have a monopoly power given the fact that there is Motrin and ibuprofen and Excedrin and all these other stuff on the market. But even if there was monopoly power early on during the patent term, the mere fact that somebody's paying me royalties doesn't necessarily mean that there's a monopoly power once the patent expires because other companies can enter. So I'm not quite sure that royalties in and of itself would extend the patent term beyond that which was contemplated by Congress. And that's, I think, why everybody now agrees that Brulati was wrong, who decided as a matter of economic theory. So whether or not this would have portended overruling of other patent misuse doctrines had Kimball come out the other way, I don't think so, in part because this was just such an odd decision that's A, so easy to get around, and B, just doesn't comport with a proper understanding of what patent does and does not do and what royalties do and do not pay for.
Right, and Professor, are you aware of, in the parallel area of copyright, whether there's a similar either case law, common law, notion of copyright misuse and the extension of the copyright term beyond its statutory period, and how that would tie into patent or antitrust in general?
Well, there are similar doctrines in copyright that animate copyright law to patent law. You can misuse your exclusive rights in either area. However, with copyright being so long, currently, copyright lasts for the life of the author plus 70 years on top of that. It becomes a little bit sort of harder to see those, I guess, cases in action just because of the length of time that copyright is present. And then, of course, on top of that, Congress has been in many ways much more solicitous of copyright holders than it has been of patent holders. So Congress has extended the duration of copyright on multiple occasions. So I remember when I was at Long Island Law School, there was a case that was also in the Supreme Court. That name escapes me right now, but basically it challenged the Copyright Term Extension Act, where Congress just simply tacked on another 20 years to existing copyrights, moving it from life plus 50 to life plus 70. And so in some ways, Congress itself is allowing copyright holders to extend the term of their copyright past previously agreed upon statutory expiration date by simply extending that expiration date. So it just hasn't come up, I suppose, as much in copyright.
Once again, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on the telephone. Let's take another call now.
Hi, this is Chris Green from Ole Miss Law School. I'm curious about the discussion of the reliance interests here. And, I mean, it just seems like, I mean, especially in the particular factual setting where they didn't even know about Brulati, they made a contract thinking it was going to last longer than it ended up lasting. I mean, it's kind of this upsetting reliance interest just because of its kind of not freedom of contract nature of the decision. So I'm looking at the stuff at the top of page 10 of the opinion, and it has this language, where they kind of come up with this story. Well, maybe people drafted these indefinite things in reliance on Brulati, and they say, well, we have no idea. To be honest, we don't know.
Right.
And then it has this thing, but even uncertainty on this score cuts in Marvel's direction so long as we see a reasonable possibility that parties have structured their business transactions in light of Brulati, we have one more reason to let it stand. I mean, that seems like a really big change in the relevance of reliance interest and the way you assess the existence of reliance interest and which reliance interests count in stare decisis law. Because, I mean, it seems like the other reliance interest actually happened here, and they just don't care at all about it. And that seems really weird.
Right. I think that's exactly right. I will, you know, preface it by saying I'm not a contracts person. So, you know, so I don't want to get into the weeds of contracts law and reliance interest in contract law. But I think that's exactly right. And I think Justice Alito calls out a majority just on that point, basically stating that, you know, this is not, you know, this is just not a good argument on the part of majority, that there is absolutely no record that Marvel managed to bring to the court that anybody has relied on Brulati. And in any event, to the extent that, as he points out, to the extent that anybody has, and, you know, there's any sort of fear out there about reviving long dormant contracts because parties have thought that Brulati would basically put a hard stop on any indefinite term contracts, but now somebody would want to revive them, that that's not really a problem because the courts will be able to enforce parties' expectations as in they would in any other contract agreement. So this is very much, he accused the majority in very polite terms, but basically that was kind of a sleight of hand of misunderstanding what reliance is. Now, whether or not this is anything more than kind of a not well, very well thought through dicta, or does it portend a larger change in what majority will count as a reliance interest? I don't know. I mean, I think I just I can't quite put my finger on it. If I were a betting man, I would think it's probably the former. I think it's just one of the arguments that the court sort of wanted to marshal for this case, not perhaps the strongest argument. But, you know, sometimes Supreme Court opinions have a life of their own, and they get cited in various ways that were not previously expected.
Thanks.
We still have some time left. If you have a question for our expert, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see if anybody else has a question. Professor, let me ask you. You mentioned the ease with which Brulati could be avoided by a good draftsmanship. I know one of those avenues was discussed in a blog by John Duffy. Your discussion made it sound like maybe one of the opinions, the majority or the dissenting opinion, discussed that. And did they actually provide roadmap advice on how to get around Brulati in
They majority. Actually do. Majority does it.
Does that surprise you?
Well, in some sense, because, I mean, majority is basically saying, look, we're reaffirming Brulati, but don't worry about it. Just get good lawyers and ignore our opinion. It's an odd way of, I think, of deciding, from my perspective, a fairly important issue of patent law and that, you know, and of patent licensing that affects a large chunk of our economy. It seems just an odd way of empowering or of just giving extra jobs to lawyers. And look, I know that mostly on this call they're mostly attorneys, and I don't want to sort of take food away from their mouth. It's great that they get to make more money by billing more hours by drafting more complicated contracts, but it just seems an odd way of going about saying we have this hard and fast rule, but, you know, be creative and bill more hours and get around this rule as well. But, yes, majority spends a fair amount of time talking about how this can be avoided by joint venture and this can be avoided by amortizing loans. On page, I believe, I'm looking at it right now, it's on page 6 of the opinion, the court says, Brulati poses, and I quote, Brulati poses no bar to business arrangements other than royalties, all kinds of joint ventures, for example, that enable parties to share risk and rewards for commercializing the invention. So basically they're saying that as long as you don't use these poisonous words of patent royalties, anything goes. It's just you got to avoid, you know, those words or implications that you're just charging for the patent itself past its expiration date.
Yeah, that strikes me as extremely odd, too. It's as if they're saying this is good law, but here's how you can avoid it. Does Justice Alito in his dissent criticize the court for that sort of discussion, or does he let that pass?
I don't think he gets into that. I have to I don't have his opinion memorized. But I think he focuses more on why Brulati was so wrongly decided and why stare decisis does not apply to them. Although he does talk about, on page, I think, 3 of his dissent, 3-4, he does talk about how that there are good reasons, and again, I quote, there are good reasons why parties sometimes prefer post-expiration royalties over upfront fees and why such arrangements have pro-competitive effects. And so then he explains why that actually happened. So he doesn't specifically call majority out for saying here's a roadmap to avoiding our decision, but he does explain why perhaps those ways to get around it may not always be enough.
Okay. Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've still got some time left if there are questions lingering. I don't see any questions, but let me remind the audience of the cases that are yet pending. We've got the Texas Department of Housing case. That's a disparate impact case left. The Arizona redistricting case, the Obamacare case, the Michigan EPA case, a mandatory sentencing under the Armed Criminal Career Act statute, the same-sex marriage case, and the lethal injection case, all to be decided, it sounds like, Thursday, Friday, and Monday. So do check the website and monitor your emails for calls as we schedule them. Before we adjourn, Professor Dolan, let me give you a chance to express any final thought or wrap up on the case we're talking about today, the Marvel case.
I think I've said mostly what I wanted to say, and I'm looking forward to the next few opinions in Telefora. I think it's going to be an interesting rest of the week.
Well, thank you so much, Professor. We certainly appreciate you, as always, being ready and able to give us your insights into these cases as they're argued and then as they're decided. We certainly appreciate it. To our audience, thank you as well for dialing in. We look forward to you joining that next Teleforum conference call. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.